Thursday mornings, filling the hours of their long, aimless young lives. But Jess was dead now, like nearly all of Mrs. Blessing's friends, and her daughter had grown from a young girl into a middle-aged woman. She and Mrs. Blessing, once a generation apart, had somehow become contemporaries and second-hand friends of a sort. Still, Jean and Ed were always deferential. "Where did you find him?" Ed asked, cocking his head to one side. Nadine made a snorting noise as she passed around the cubed cheese and olives. Mrs. Blessing made Nadine stay late when she had dinner guests, although Nadine stubbornly refused to wear a uniform. "Nadine doesn't countenance change," Ed said, with that twinkle that Mrs. Blessing had always found so irritating. "Pick up like dog," Nadine said. "No references, no nothing." "That's enough, Nadine," Mrs. Blessing had said. Nadine did not like change, but then neither did Lydia Blessing. It had been many years since she had cared to travel outside of Mount Mason, more than 30 since she'd driven up Park Avenue, which had once been the main street of her life. She liked her routines now, her breakfast, her times, her letters posted, a light lunch, a walk around the pond with her stick at her side, perhaps a surreptitious doze in one of the Adirondack chairs with a book face down on her lap, an hour of talk shows on television, an hour of news, a bowl of soup, two drinks, and an early bed. She didn't sleep most of the night. She rested for the day ahead and thought about the days behind. It was a puzzle to her, how eagerly she'd rushed into life when she was 18 or 20, and in what a desultory fashion it had dragged out ever since. Even when she had been younger, 30, 40 years before, when there had been long house parties at Blessing's and games of golf and swimming at midnight and dinners for 12, even then, the days were so long, and the years somehow so short. "Nadine," she called, sipping at her coffee. "Nadine, tell Charles not to prune the hydrangeas, or the rhodies, not until fall. Nadine?" She watched Nadine march across the drive, clenched fists at her side. "What a brave thing to do, hiring someone like that, Lydia," Ed had said. But Mrs. Blessing knew people, and she had recognized in the young man holding jumper cables in the Walmart parking lot that delicate balance between efficiency and servility that had characterized the very best servants of her childhood and youth. The cook here at Blessing's had had it, and the head gardener and the man who attended the cows and taught Miss Lydia and Master Blessing how to pull down on the soft udders and aim right into their open mouths so that the milk was warm and sweet on their lips. The maids in the city house had somehow never had it. But perhaps that was because of the way Father had treated them, brushing against them sometimes in the hallway when he thought no one was looking, using the serving spoon so that the upper part of his arm gently touched the curve of a breast beneath a white bib and gray cotton. How handsome he'd been, with his center-parted yellow hair and his mustache and his full bottom lip and bright blue eyes. When Nadine spoke to the new man, Mrs. Blessing saw him jump slightly, answering Nadine over his shoulder as though he did not want her to see his face. He moved oddly, as though he were stiff or hurt, as though he'd thrown his back out and couldn't straighten up. "Hard work never hurt anyone," Mrs. Blessing's father used to say, as he walked with her around the place, swinging his stick, although he'd never worked hard a day in his life. Nadine was walking back toward the house, and the young man had resumed his raking. He'd learn, this one, Lydia Blessing thought. She had a feeling about him. She'd just have to remember to tell Nadine to remind him to straighten up. There was no point in having him throw his back out the very first month on the job. He hadn't been this afraid since his first week in county jail, when he was convinced that any minute some big guy was going to jump him. Or as tired, for that matter. A deadbeat dad who worked with him in the laundry finally took pity on him. "You can get some sleep, Junior," the man had said, stuffing sheets in the big top-loading machine. "The worst it gets in here is when somebody body-checks somebody else during a basketball game." "I don't play basketball," Skip had replied. "There you go, then," the older man said. The rider mower was going round and round in a clean, monotonous motion that was putting him to sleep. The windows of the house glittered in the sunlight so that it was impossible to see if someone was watching him. He hadn't been this afraid since he sat in the parking lot at the Quick Stop and watched Chris shout into the clerk's face through the smoggy glass of the window. And at least then he'd known what crime he was committing, waiting with the engine running for someone with a cash register's worth of dirty bills stuffed into a brown bag. He'd been afraid now for more than a week, but he wasn't certain exactly what he was guilty of. When he looked into the bottom drawer of an old bureau he'd lined with a blanket at the baby, looking closely for any sign of life, he wondered whether this was kidnapping or theft or some sort of accessory thing. Maybe it was a parole violation of some sort, harboring a minor child. Mainly, he wondered how long he could trim and tend 200 acres of land with his spine curled around a baby strapped to his chest and an old woman watching him from the window. "She must think I'm the Hunchback of Notre Dame," he said aloud without meaning to speak, and the small downy head stirred slightly. "Please, please, please, please don't wake up," he whispered. "Please." He'd had a dog once. In that way, he'd had everything in his childhood. Ordinary, but a lot less lasting. It had been a beagle mix puppy of some kind, with a sharp bark and long incisors and a tail that swept knickknacks off low surfaces. One evening, it tore open a bag of garbage left at the curb, scattering tin cans and pieces of waxed paper across the lawn. The next, it soiled the thin beige wall-to-wall that was the jewel of his mother's living room. "We gave him to a family with a farm, son," his father had said when he got home from school. "The farm deal," Chris had said, curling his lip. "That's what they always tell you." Skip had heard his mother sighing on the telephone to her sister. "You don't realize the constant responsibility," she said, "like the kind you have with a baby where you can't do a single thing for yourself." It was the kind of thing she always said, as though he wouldn't hear or wouldn't take it personally if he did. Now he knew she was right. That first day, the baby had slept with a release and abandon that made him conclude it was sick, or sometimes, when the light did not fall fully on the small, slack body, actually dead. He'd checked to make sure it was breathing right around twilight, and then left to go shopping at the Walmart. He figured that was probably a crime, too, leaving an infant alone. But he knew from watching one of the bartender's girlfriends change their twins on the back table at McGuire's that he was going to need Pampers and something to put in a bottle. He'd picked up skim milk because it seemed healthiest, and Pampers with a stay-dry lining in the newborn size, and some plastic bottles with balloons painted on the side, and a book on baby care, and a canvas sling that let you carry an infant strapped close to your chest, and any piece of clothing with ducks on it that he could find. He had slithered up to the registers with his head down and the bill of his John Deere hat pulled low, in case any of the girls knew him from high school or hanging at the bar, trying to get in and out and back to the house in the pickup truck before the old lady noticed he was gone, or the mottled squirming thing in the box awoke. He spent $81.19 at the Walmart, half of it on things it turned out he wouldn't need until later. Baby food in jars, a cup that popped right back up when you tipped it over, a rattle. When he'd pulled into the garage, he'd listened and heard the baby screaming from above, tearing into it in short bursts like a car alarm. It was another reason to be glad that the garage was so far from the house, far enough so that maybe the old lady wouldn't hear. Before he'd gone out, he'd taken the baby out of the bureau drawer and put it back in the box and put the box under his bed, just in case. The damp, flushed face was covered with a sifting of gray dust, like what was on the Christmas ornaments when he was a boy, and they took them out to decorate the tree, he and his dad, on their own. The cheeks and forehead looked swollen, almost bruised beneath the ruddy sheen of baby rage, and the eyes were slits. The gray silt shone like mica in the down that promised to become eyebrows. "Okay," he had said, lifting the baby out of the box by the armpits, the flannel shirt coming unwrapped, the whole of the little body dangling, naked legs bowed like parentheses. "It's a girl," he thought to himself as he looked down at the shrimp pink body, thinking that maybe worry was making him punch drunk, and that maybe there was a different kind of crime involved in harboring a girl baby. He carried her into the kitchen and laid her wailing on the counter while he poured the milk into the baby bottle and turned on the radio. "Okay," He kept repeating, okay, okay, okay. And Jesus, the blessed weight of silence when he put the nipple in her mouth and she shut up. No sound but Patsy Cline singing Crazy on the country station. Skip knew he should put a diaper on her, but he was afraid to remove the flannel shirt entirely, afraid to move her little legs, afraid to wake her again, once she'd dropped off after eating, her head hanging heavy to one side of his cradling arm. When he'd had her naked on the counter, he was afraid she was having a seizure. Her arms and legs splayed and shook convulsively, as though she were trying to grab at the air. But now the tremors were gone, and he wanted to keep it that way. He was afraid to put her down, too, so he sat in an old rocking chair and rocked her gently, urine seeping warmly into his pants. "Don't poop, baby," he whispered. "Don't poop." He was still murmuring when she turned her head and vomited so violently that the milk hit the wall and the window. "Oh, shit," he'd said, and the crying began again. He was amazed that he'd gotten through that first night. Clean her up, put on the diaper, put on a shirt, put on the sling, pick up the book, read about formula, curse himself out, drive down the highway to a convenience store, and buy enough cans of the stuff to feed a dozen babies. When the sun began to come up over the pond, he was cleaning sour milk off the window panes with the baby in the sling, and a new day stretched before him during which he was expected to rake the flower beds and clean the pond spillway and ride the mower. "I can't keep doing this," he said to himself, but somehow he did. He'd been doing it for 10 days, a full day of work, most of it done with the baby on his chest, a wet spot of perspiration and drool always now faintly cool in the center of his sternum. Sometimes, after she ate, she would sleep so deeply that he felt safe leaving her upstairs while he sprinted around, caulking windows, spraying the tomato plants. He went back again to the Walmart, this time to buy a monitor he saw on television, so that he could hear what was happening above the garage when he was outside. He learned how to slump on the tractor, hunch his shoulders to make a valley for the small rounds of head and bottom. When he saw the glint of Mrs. Blessing's binoculars, he turned his back. He thought he knew what Mrs. Blessing would say about this. He didn't know her well yet, but the first thing he'd noticed about her were those small, sharp lines radiating from around her mouth. The lines a woman got when she'd been pursing her lips in disapproval for years at the wayward ways of the world. And he realized she would figure out what he already had. That someone had left this baby here not for him, the sad sack caretaker who didn't even have a checking account, but for her, the richest woman in Mount Mason. "She say radio too loud at night," Nadine called across the pond to him. "Tell her I'm sorry and it won't happen again," he called back. The radio was to cover the sound of crying, and the crying was for no reason he could fathom. Sometimes the baby seemed to have gas, and she would lift her knees to her chest, groan and fart and groan again, then scream, then drop off for 20 minutes, then wake with a start in his arms and scream some more. He rocked her and rocked her and turned the pages of the baby book and looked for an explanation and fed her and rocked again. "You've just been given the most miraculous gift imaginable," the baby book said. Skip thought colic was a possibility. Or maybe she was just pissed off that her mother had ditched her at Blessings and hadn't even had the brains to leave her at the big house. The fibrous stump of the umbilical cord, brown with dried blood, had been clamped off near the rounded belly with a blue enamel butterfly hair clip, the kind he'd seen the high school girls wearing at the mall. In the morning, she always stopped crying, as though the thin light at the window mollified her. Sometimes she seemed to stare right through him, her eyes a dark, clear blue, a small bubble of a blister forming at the center of her upper lip. Her legs and arms moved in strange calisthenics as he cleaned her with a warm cloth. "Okay," he said. "It's okay. I'm gonna take care of you. It'll be okay, okay?" But by the end of the workday, he was ready to drop. So tired that one day he drove back to the pasture behind the barn and slept in the back of the truck in the midday sun, waking to find his clothes soaked through with sweat and half his face sunburned to an angry purple red. Some days he was so tired that the percussion of the pistons in the rider mower would begin to put him to sleep. and he'd start awake and look back at the slightly wavy trail that came with cutting the lawn half-conscious. Even when he did sleep, it was hardly like sleep at all, more like slipping in and out of daydreams, like the sleep was as thin as the cotton sheets that were all he used in bed at night because it was so damn hot in the apartment over the garage. He had two fans. Mrs. Blessing had said something about it to Nadine. Two fans, lots of electricity. What did she care, with all her money? He couldn't tell her that one fan pushed the hot air over him and the other over the deep bottom drawer to the old dresser that was filled with a wadded-up satin bedspread he'd found in the cupboard and the baby he'd found in a box. "What is it you want?" he'd said in an angry whisper one night just after 4 in the morning. "What the hell is your problem?" It was as if, unformed as she was, she could read the rough anger beneath the words. The incessant crying turned to choppy wails, and she began to scream until she was gasping for breath, her face as brightly colored as his sunburn. He wanted to shake her. Instead, he took her into a room at the back of the apartment that had one small window facing toward the fields. In it there was only a daybed, and he laid her on it, closed the door, and walked up and down the hallway. "I can't do this," he whispered to himself. "I can't. I just can't." After 10 minutes, he went back in and lifted her to his shoulder. "I can't do this," he said. Her face was wet against his neck. "This is nuts," he muttered. "This is really crazy." 4 a.m., and the darkness had a quality of inexorability and menace, as though it would never lift, as though without anyone noticing it, the dawn of the day before had been the beginning of the last light ever in the history of the world. He finally felt the baby go limp as a half-spilled sack of flour, just as he looked out the bathroom window and saw a line of blue-gray appear around the edge of the pond, signaling dawn. He could not have said when it was exactly that he decided to keep her or why. It made no sense. He'd never thought much about having children, and having one now would cause considerable trouble, as he'd already learned. But he knew that there were things that seemed lunatic to the world that you decided to do anyhow. That was what his father must have felt, working as a long-distance trucker, seeing less and less of his son, meeting a woman who was waiting tables at the restaurant in the Quality Inn near Tampa, finding out once again how it felt to roll over in bed and find the sheets no longer cold, deciding to stay in Florida, although he had a house and his son 1,000 miles north. Or maybe it was the damn dog he kept thinking about. Over the years, whenever they'd passed a farm in his uncle's truck, he'd stared out the window at the barns and the fields and the long gravel drives and looked for an old beagle basking in the sun. He just wished there'd been something permanent about his life, something he could look at or hold or keep in his dresser drawer that spoke of years of cereal breakfasts, after-school milk, homework at the kitchen table, family trips to the county fair, or just those moments before sleep when the ceiling of your room was as familiar as your face in the mirror. There was no premium in it for him. He was certain there'd be trouble if anyone found out, and he was certain that sooner or later Mrs. Blessing or Nadine or someone would hear a noise in the night or see the dome of the head peeking from the neck of his shirt. But a couple days in, he'd realized that no matter how often and how haphazardly he put his index finger in her creased little palm, she would surround it with her fingers like a greeting. "Your baby will hold tight to your hand," the book burbled, and without realizing it, he'd fixed on that one word, the word "your." Or maybe it wasn't that at all. Maybe it was when he was raking out the old branches underneath the stand of birch trees along the fence that bordered Rolling Hills Road and was surprised by a small sound, like the one the deer made when they were startled and realized that she had sneezed. "Bless you," he murmured, and when he knocked off at the end of the day, he looked up colds in the book's index. Maybe he didn't really have a choice, like so many people who wound up with children haphazardly, accidentally. When he thought of what else he could do, he could imagine only various cold and cruelly lit rooms that smelled of disinfectant. The hospital in Mount Mason, where he'd had his leg set when he was 14, and his burns treated when the deep-fat fryer at Burger King spit back at his scrawny bicep just before closing one night, leaving a magenta blot. The police station that looked like an elementary school and smelled like one, too. Lysol and fried food and cigarettes, where he'd sat on a bench with his hands cuffed behind him after the robbery. the courthouse that had been refurbished in the 60s, so that it was still a grand limestone hulk without, but inside a maze of particle board paneling and checkerboard linoleum and gray metal desks. He wasn't taking anybody to any of those places of impermanence and phony concern. He might as well drop this baby down a well and listen for the splash. He knew those people. They'd piss away a couple of years passing around paper, looking for a mother who just wanted to be left in peace. The little girl would be 3 years old and still living in some lousy foster home with people who spent the money the state sent on Camel lights and a satellite dish. He bought some disposable cameras and he took her picture, sleeping, waking, even screaming. Her angry maroon color had faded by the beginning of the second week to an almost ghostly white with a faint mottling of pink like the flowers on the magnolia trees along the drive. Her umbilical cord fell off, scaring the hell out of him until he saw the small, neat navel in its place. And he took the barrette that had been clipped to the cord and the cardboard box and the flannel shirt and put them all together on the top shelf of the closet in the back room. He put the cameras next to them. He was constructing a history for her the way he wished someone had constructed one for him. And as though she knew all this, on the 10th day, she rested. He lined the bottles up in the refrigerator, put her down, and fell asleep himself, expecting to wake to crying in an hour or two. And instead she slept until 3, woke and ate, went back to sleep, complained just before dawn, drank down a bottle, scarcely waking, and went back to sleep again. Her small mouth pursed, her fingers splayed, until around 9 o'clock. So he had had time to go up the basement steps, make the coffee for Mrs. Blessing, clear fallen branches from the drive, and water the vegetables and the zinnias before she woke, demanding more. In the afternoon, he rode the tractor far from the house and took her from the sling to lay her on a towel beneath leggy elm trees waving in the wind. A breeze blew, and her eyes widened, and he swore that she smiled vacantly at the sky. The book said that she wouldn't smile for weeks, but he knew what he'd seen. "Whoa," he said, kneeling beside her. Solemnly she blinked, closed her eyes, and tightened her fist around his finger. As far as Skip was concerned, that was that. She was his. Often, in the middle of the night, Lydia Blessing had wakened to the sound of a baby's cries. Over the years, she had learned to identify the sources. Sometimes something as pedestrian as the wail of a cat in heat. Occasionally the high, thin call of the coyote, which had snuck back into this part of the Northeast from the West a decade before. The first few months after she had discovered she was pregnant, when the new wedding band, while slender, felt like some unexpected wheel on her finger, the cries had seemed to be the spectral calls of the child within. That was after she had moved her things from her parents' house in the city to Blessing's for what she had vaguely thought of as a wartime interlude, Benny's letters on transparent airmail paper arriving in the old rural route mailbox. And then Meredith had been born, and the cries had been real, yet somehow as foreign as their imaginary counterparts. Slowly she would struggle through the veil of her dreams to the momentary sinister forms of the lamp, the dresser, the highboy, and the desk ranged around her bedroom, and for a moment she would wonder whose baby that was, crying. Her legs would struggle with the sheets, the blankets, and then there would come the even tap-tap-tap of the footsteps of the baby nurse that her mother had hired and sent out from the city, a thin woman with cropped hair and a faint Middle European accent, who played solitaire in the kitchen in her off hours. Lydia Blessing could remember in those early weeks thinking she would not be able to go back to sleep, hearing the tick of the mantel clock, feeling the soreness where she'd been stitched straight up the middle after the cesarean birth. And then she would waken again to the bright, clear light of full day through the branches of the maple outside the bedroom window. She never slept that deep sleep now, and her bedroom in the dark was as familiar as the dimpled face of the moon over the pond. In the last 2 weeks, the cries had come again, more plaintive and more demanding, even than those she had heard when there was truly a baby in the house. Sometimes she thought she was dreaming of those days, 60 years ago now, when Meredith had cried and been comforted in some fashion by that foreign woman who carried the small flannel-wrapped bundle under her arm like a loaf of fractious bread. Sometimes she would start awake, then realize she was hearing the sound of a radio faintly from the garage apartment. She had told Nadine to put a stop to that. Tonight she could hear nothing but the steady timpani of thunder rolling in from the northeast. She went to the window and peered out into the darkness, but the storm clouds had muted a half moon. Most of the time she could see one corner of the barn roof from the sleeping porch off her bedroom, one green shingled curve, and one of the lightning rods. A horse in full canter in copper faded to a dull brown. She had put the horse atop the rod herself, held around her waist by her father at the top of a long, long ladder, held steady by two of the men who had built the barn. "Must everything be a show?" her mother had said in the dining room that morning when her father had suggested it. Ethel Blessing had not even come down to watch. She had stayed on the long front porch, in a rocking chair, while everyone, the servants, the workmen, the gardeners, had come to see Lydia lift the glowing copper horse into place. She remembered that it had been warm in her hands. Sunny had been at Benny Carton's house in Rhode Island that day, she remembered. It was her only disappointment. Her father had built the barn in the summer of 1930, when there were no jobs in Mount Mason. The father and an uncle of one of the girls in Lydia's class at Bertram's had killed themselves after the stock market crash, and two of the girls in her class had gone elsewhere, even though Miss Bertram had offered them scholarships. But Lydia's mother had never believed in the stock market, or even banks for that matter, and somehow all of the money from the business she had inherited from her father, which had once been called Simpson's Dry Goods, but was now called Simpson's Fine Textiles, was safe. They moved not long after the crash from a narrow house on 77th Street near Lexington Avenue to the larger house on 74th Street near the park, a house that was sold at a considerable loss by a man who had had to be hospitalized at Flower Fifth Avenue Hospital just before the Christmas holidays after he realized that all his capital was gone. The people in Mount Mason had been glad of the work, and the barn had gone up fast, the wall supports and roof struts laid out flat in the middle of the big grass gully next to the swamp that Edwin Blessing had decided upon for its site. He had also decided that Sonny should work on the barn with the hired laborers from town. "Make a man of him," Mr. Blessing kept saying, as though even character could be contracted out. "Teach him the value of hard work." Sonny had been 13 years old that summer. His hair grew pale as sunlight and his skin golden. Lydia thought her brother was beautiful. "I was so in love with him when we were children," Jess had told her one day when they were waiting to have lunch until Sonny's train came in, the children passing time playing Pachisi in the library. "He was so dear." Lydia remembered that Sonny had not arrived for lunch that day, had come on the last evening train smelling of gin, a fresh cut at the corner of one eye. She had put him to bed in his usual room. "I'm a bad boy, Liddy," he'd muttered, belching loudly and then falling asleep, as though he'd been given an anesthetic. 50 years ago that had been, and she could still see his tanned arm dangling from the single bed. Her sheets were cool as she slid back between them, shining white as a nightlight in the dark room. In the years that Blessings had been hers and hers alone, she had never had a colored sheet in the house. She intended to keep it that way. White towels, too. She had not been down to the barn in many years. It was deserted now, empty of all but pigeons and mice and the odd foraging fox. There was a long, steep slope down to it. The builder had said that was the disadvantage to the site, but Father had wanted it there, with a long back drive to the road and a deep pasture to one side. The wife of the farmer from whom he'd bought the cows wept in the doorway as they were driven into a truck with open slatted sides. And Lydia, who was in the old Lincoln with her father, had thought that the farmer's wife must know each cow individually and was sad to have them leave. Bessie, Brownie, Calico the calf. Perhaps she was saying goodbye in her mind. Years later, Lydia had told the story at a dinner party, described the woman in the pink-flowered apron holding open the screen door with her hip, wiping her eyes with the hem of the apron, watching the black-and-white cattle lumbering up the ramp, her husband prodding them with a sharpened broomstick. and Jess had left before coffee and dessert, and next morning had called Lydia and told her in that choked and breathy voice she used when she was angry that the reason the woman was crying was that the sale of the cows was the only thing that had forestalled foreclosure on a farm that had been in her family since before the Civil War. Jess had known because her father was the president of the bank that held the mortgage. "I had no way of knowing that, for pity's sake," Lydia had said. "That's forever your problem," Jess had said. "You ought to have known. There are always these things that you ought to know, and yet somehow you don't. Open your eyes, Lydia. You are not the center of the universe." Those were the two people who had been the center of her universe, Jess and Sonny, both of them gone now. And the people she had thought she'd loved were gone, too, her father, who had built Blessings and then lost it to his wife and daughter, and Frank Askew, still handsome and sleepy-eyed in his obituary photograph in the Times 15 years ago, still married to Ella, still on the hospital board and the Bedford Town Council. Both men had sung to her, "Let me call you sweetheart, I'm in love with you." Her father would sing in his clear tenor as he danced her around the drawing room of the house in the city. "Night and day, you are the one," Frank had sung one night at a Deb ball for one of his daughters at the club. There had been a breakfast afterward at the Askew apartment on Park Avenue, and he'd locked the door to one of the maid's rooms and made love to her on the single bed. And all the time she'd been able to hear Ella Askew down the hall, with her distinctive voice loud and bright as dinner chimes, tell a long story about difficulties with the tent for her sister's lawn wedding. "Beautiful," Frank kept whispering. "Beautiful." She was shamed by it all, flushed bright as a peach, but perhaps that had been the pleasure, too. At age 20, her body had seemed to have a mind of its own, to open of its own accord, as automatic as a heartbeat. It was hard to imagine now. Once she had said to Jess, when they had finished a bottle of wine out on the terrace during the long lunches they had had, the children grown and the men gone, when they were back to what they'd been as girls, "I'm 60 years old and I've never seen a man completely naked." "Oh, Lids," Jess had said. "Oh, dear." And then, "Well, it's not all it's cracked up to be." They'd laughed till they cried, just cried. Jess had come back to her then for a few years. She had not meant to leave Lydia alone. She had simply done that most perfidious of things, made a happy marriage with a good man who loved her and did everything he could possibly think of, from emerald earrings to keeping the children quiet on Saturday mornings, to show her that he did. They had both been married at the beginning of the war, she and Jess, and they had both been widowed during it. But Jess had made another life, 2 sons, 3 daughters, and Roger, and Lydia never had. Her life was a life in sepia and black and white with deckled edges, framed in silver, mounted in scrapbooks. It had been a former life, even years ago. There was a clammy stillness to the warm summer air, as though the atmosphere were exhaling slowly. An enormous moth danced on the window screen by the head of her bed, determined to get to the faint light filtering up from the hallway lamp downstairs, or to die trying. His wings made a sound like a deck of cards being shuffled, and his feet clicked against the wire mesh. For a moment she thought she had dropped off to sleep, heard in her dreams the sound of those old trucks climbing the rise from the drive, and then heading down to where the barn was being built, their gears straining with a deep rumble. Then she remembered that it was the 4th of July, and that there would be fireworks in Mount Mason. That was how she had first met Jess, when her father had taken her to the big field behind the train tracks to watch the holiday fireworks. "The bombs bursting in air," he'd roared, his car lurching along the dirt roads. Jess's father had invited her to share his daughter's blanket, and he and Ed Blessing had shared a bottle. "You should have come, Sonny," she'd said next morning. "I met a nice girl." "Whose daughter was that?" her mother had demanded. But her father had mouthed the words "bank president," and then it had been all right. But after that, they had always had their own fireworks, and Lydia had done the same once the house was hers. 1/4, there had been 30 people staying at the house, sleeping on the patio divans, doubling up in the bedrooms, and they'd had starbursts and Roman candles at midnight, and then strawberry shortcake and champagne sitting on quilts spread around the front lawn. She remembered that Jess had not liked the people who came from the city. She thought they drank too much, and one of the women, she thought it was Penny Lind, had tried to sit on Roger's lap. There was another boom, and then another, and a series of them in waves, and she couldn't parse out which were fireworks and which the storm building overhead. There was the silken sound of wind pushing the tree branches aside, and her room was lit silver with a strike of lightning nearby. The rain came with another gust of wind and a faint groaning sound from the old house, and the thunder again, sure of itself this time, filling the air. She hoped the Fosters were checking to make sure the barn doors were closed. Then she remembered that the Fosters were gone. There had been Fosters in Mount Mason for years and years. There had been blessings for Lydia's lifetime, and soon there would be none. "Don't say anything to Mother and Father," Sonny had said when he came up from the barn that first day he was supposed to be working, holding his right arm with his left one, a scratch across his cheek. She'd been sitting on the grass by the frog pond, holding some new barn kittens in her lap, and in the slanting sun, she could see the pale down on his face where his beard was coming in. He got through dinner, eating left-handed without anyone noticing, and somehow he made it through the night, although in the morning he looked as if he hadn't slept at all. Lydia wondered how he'd gotten on his dungarees and the frayed white shirt from his old-school uniform that he wore to work on the barn. "Mr. Blessing, sir, this arm's broken," the foreman had said, jerking his head towards Sonny, when her father had gone down to stand around and talk about the progress of his barn. Mr. Foster drove them to the little hospital in Mount Mason, and she held Sonny's hand while the doctor set his arm. He'd cried out twice, turned white, then red, tiny beads of perspiration like pearls along his forehead. Then he'd fallen against her. "I need some salts in here," the doctor had yelled to a nurse while Lydia held Sonny's slack dead weight. "That boy's a disappointment," her father had said after they put him on the train to Newport to stay with Benny Carton. When he came home, Sonny said he'd learned to sail with just one arm. The rain was strong now, like the sound of gravel falling on the old slate roof. A gust blew a handful of drops through the screen and onto her pillow. Mrs. Blessing struggled slowly to her feet and brought down the sash. Her left arm was aching where she supposed she'd slept on it. She began to drift off again when a clap of thunder like an explosion settled over the house. They'd used dynamite to blow open the earth, to pour the cement foundation for the barn. She remembered being deaf and dazzled afterward, as though all her senses had been rattled by the sound. The thunder was like that, and on its heels another jab of lightning, so bright this time that for a moment it outdid the outdoor lights. Then the light outside her window and the ones by the front door and front walk went out. She realized, looking from her pillow into a black night deep as a well, that the lights in the hallway and kitchen had gone out too. She was irritated, and then, when she smelled burning, afraid. The alarm for the house went off with a shrill scream, and she pressed her hands to her temples. When she could bear the sound no longer, she stepped into her house slippers and felt her way down the stairs, as though she were a blind woman, her white gown rippling like a sail in a high wind, driven by the gusts coming in through the bedroom windows, the hallway windows, and finally when she had touched each step tentatively on the way down, the windows downstairs. The alarm would not turn off. Her foot slid on a patch of rainwater in the hallway and she started to fall, then caught the knob of a closet door. Feeling along the walls, she sank into the wing chair in the living room and lifted the phone. There was no sound. The burning smell was stronger. "Damn," she said aloud in the empty house with no one to hear, with the ringing and the thunder and the percussion of the heavy rain drowning out the word. From inside the closet, she took out her raincoat and then tied a scarf around her hair. On the dining room table, there was a bell that she used to call Nadine sometimes, and she took it to the back door and swung it frantically, the rain blowing into her face. The small silvery sound was nothing to the din. There were no lights on in the garage apartment and no sign of life. In the kitchen drawer, there was a large flashlight. She swung the beam around the room, then stamped one foot in rage and frustration. The sound of the alarm was intolerable, like having a tooth drilled. By the time she got to the stairs leading up to the garage apartment, her slippers were soaked through. The rain was sluicing down the drive in great sheets, and during one long lightning strike, she could see the pond, roiled by the wind, and a big limb from the willow tree lying on the lawn. "Charles!" she cried up the narrow stairway. "Charles!" There was a faint echo. She was appalled by the notion of finding him sleeping. It was not that she felt she was intruding on his privacy, more that he was intruding on hers by forcing her to come up to his living quarters and ask for help when he should already be providing it as a matter of course. Even here, the screeching of the alarm was loud. She shone the flashlight around the apartment kitchen and frowned as she saw how untidy it was with cans and saucepans ranged around the counter. She edged her way down the hall. "Charles!" she called again. The door to the biggest bedroom was closed, and she knocked, then knocked again. When she opened it, she could see that the bed was made. There were two fans in the window, and both of them had blown water onto the wood floor before the power outage shut them down. Beneath one of the windows was a bureau drawer, and as she shone the flashlight into it, she moved closer to peer inside. There was a baby sleeping on its side, a rolled towel behind its back to keep it propped in position. There was a faint, luminous freckling on one cheek, the mark of raindrops that had blown in but not waked it. Mrs. Blessing stood there until her legs threatened to give out. The hem of her nightgown dripped onto the floor. For just a moment, she wondered whether she was having a particularly strange dream. Finally, she found her way to the living room and sat down in a shabby chair by the window. She shone the flashlight on the old-fashioned striped material and remembered that the chair had once been in her father's study, to one side of the fireplace there. It seemed the only bit of sanity in the wild, cacophonous night, and she clutched its arms. After a few minutes, she went back to check, but the child was still there, sleeping peacefully while the alarm screamed on. She had read about the eye of a storm, about how it was the only still place in wild weather. This appeared to be it. If anyone had asked Skip where he'd least like to be on July 4th in a thunderstorm, the answer would have been easy. McGuire's. But there he was, nursing a beer in a greasy mug, watching one of Ed's younger brothers play a pinball machine with so much body English that it looked like he was going to slam Batarama through the back wall of the bar. "Yo, dude," yelled the bartender over the noise of some country song. "Ease up on the machine." Skip looked at his watch. He figured he had roughly an hour before the baby would wake up. She'd seemed to settle in the last 2 days, eating, sleeping, with one pissed-off hour right around the end of the workday as the sun was dropping down from the sky. He had to walk her then, back and forth, but when she finally dropped off, there was a sweet quality of submission to her small body. She burped, spit up on his shirt, then went slack and silent. He realized that there was a point to that ungainly, empty area between the human shoulder and chin. It was the perfect place to rest an infant. Nadine's daughter had told Nadine, who had told him in her particular furious fashion, that some girl named Debbie had a letter for him from his father. That was the only thing that would bring him to McGuire's now, although once he'd practically lived there. He looked around at the guys nursing their beers and playing pool and wondered for the first time in his life who the hell was taking care of their kids. Women, probably, wives or girlfriends, or even their mothers, when the wives and the girlfriends went out or cut out. Skip figured he must be crazy, the only full-time single father in Mount Mason. He tapped his foot impatiently on the bar rail. He knew from living in their trailer those first few months after he got out of the county jail that Debbie cut hair during the day and worked from 10 to 2 at McGuire's 4 nights a week. She might as well work there, Joe had said, since she'd be there anyway, and she could give him free beer. McGuire's was what they all had instead of a social life. A tavern on the corner of Front and Route 211 that was long and narrow, with a pool table and a dartboard in the back room. Skip's father and uncle used to drink there, and Joe's father and Ed's, too. Chris had never had a father that anyone remembered, although Chris's mother had been known to sit at the bar at McGuire's until closing time. It set her apart when they were kids. Women went to McGuire's when they were single, and then when they were married, they went to baby showers or Tupperware parties or Weight Watchers or over to see their mother or their mother-in-law. McGuire's was owned by a family named Jackson now, and they'd gone through a period about 10 years back when they'd had somebody paint in gold letters edged in black, "Bar and Restaurant," on the plate glass window. And there were menus and fancy coffees with booze in them, Irish and Neapolitan and whatever. It hadn't been completely successful. Now, occasionally, someone would order a burger and fries, or those nachos that everyone had on the menu because you just popped them in the microwave. Most of the food consumed at McGuire's consisted of the peanuts on the bar. Lots of the food consumed at McGuire's got thrown up in the parking lot. Skip remembered the year after he graduated high school when he was working the Burger King job, kneeling on the asphalt at least once a week. One time in snow so deep that he'd lost the feeling in his knees. If he ever went back to that life, he thought, he just might as well shoot himself and get it over with. He remembered some mornings when he was living with his aunt and uncle coming into the kitchen and seeing his uncle having a beer at 11 a.m. "Breakfast of champions," his uncle had said, hoisting the can in the air. "You want another beer, Skipper?" the bartender said. "Nah," he said, "I'm driving." The bartender shrugged. "Been watching too many public service announcements," he said. "God damn it!" yelled Ed's little brother, banging his fist on the side of the pinball machine. He'd never had a letter from his father. Postcards, about twice a year, always with a picture of palm trees or a beach. When he'd been in the county jail, his father had taken a detour, after picking up a load of machine parts in Connecticut, and come to see him unexpectedly. The two of them sat at a long table that was bolted to the floor, and his father bought him soda and a ring-ding out of the vending machine. "The important thing is that you learn something from this," his father kept saying, and Skip kept nodding, thinking, "Yeah, I've learned never to drive a getaway car." But he didn't say anything. Actually, neither of them said much. His father said that Linda, who was the woman he was living with, was working as a hostess now, which was easier on her back and feet, and that the two of them had gotten a double-wide trailer that looked just like a house and came with the curtains already hung and the wallpaper already on the walls. Skip said that he was getting out in 4.5 months. They hadn't really had a lot to talk about. He wondered what was in the letter his father had sent him. He wondered if Debbie was always late to work or just tonight to torture him. He didn't even hear Chris come up beside him until he felt the iron arm around his neck. Chris smelled of beer and pot smoke, and he had a bruise on his face that looked fresh. His freckled face had that puffy, creased look that had come with sleeping in drunk when they were younger, but that just became the way you looked if you slept in drunk for enough years. He had a tattoo on his upper arm, the Tasmanian Devil. He'd gotten it one night at a place at the beach in Virginia when the four of them were all together sleeping in one room at a Motel 6. Skip had gotten sunburned, and he hurt all over, and when the tattoo artist had put the first needle in to put a lightning bolt on the back of his hand, he'd seen black stars in his peripheral vision and come to on a cot in the back with an egg coming up on the side of his head. "I'm not doing that, dude," the tattoo guy said flatly. "I got a policy." The Tasmanian Devil arched his round belly as Chris picked up his beer. "Where you been, Skippy?" he said. "How come I never see you anymore?" "You need me to drive you again?" Skip said. "Don't be a wise-ass man. You know I never wanted to fuck you up." Skip knew that in some twisted way, that was true. He and Chris had been friends since first grade. He'd always stuck by Chris, even in fourth grade, when Chris got the ski jacket from Santa Claus, the really good one with the fleece lining, wore it to school, all proud, and then caught Robert Benteman, whose father was a lawyer and a magistrate and something or other with the Chamber of Commerce, staring at it. "That's my old jacket that my mom gave away to the Salvation Army," Robert had said. And Chris was on him. Bam, bam, bam. Half the class jumping on Chris's back couldn't stop his arm from going up and down, up and down. The jacket went into the dumpster behind Newberry's once Chris found Benteman's name written inside the pocket in indelible marker, and Chris had to go to counseling, and the counselor told his mom he had poor impulse control. Memorial Day weekend last year, his impulse had been to hold up the quick stop, and Skip had been stupid enough to be driving. Chris hadn't really meant any harm, but that hadn't made 10 months running laundry through an industrial mangle any easier to take for Skip. "How's life in the Magic Kingdom?" said Chris, and Skip shrugged. "They need any part-time help out there? 'Cause I just got laid off from my sheetrocking job." Skip shrugged again. It froze him to think of Chris anywhere near Blessings or the baby. He looked at his watch. Debbie was almost half an hour late. A girl named Mary Beth down the bar waved at him. "Hey, Skip," she said, "what's new with you?" "I need a job and I need pussy," Chris murmured in his ear. "Oh, man," said Skip, putting down his beer on the bar with a thud. "Don't talk like that. You're too old for that kind of talk. That's low. That's just low, man." "Fuck you, man. You're pussy whipped by that old woman. You never come to the bar. You're never at Ed's. You miss the demo derby. What the hell is it with that place?" "When I was a kid, my Aunt Patty used to pass around the food there at parties, and she'd come home saying, 'Ooh, the silverware, the flowers, the fucking lake.' I bet you don't fish in that lake, my man, because she'll cut your heart out." Jimmy's old man went out there once, and he pulled a 22-inch brown trout out of that lake at 6 a.m, and there she was, standing on the front porch. She wanted him to weigh that goddamn trout, and she told him she wanted him to pay for it by the pound, by the fucking pound. "What did he do?" Skip said. "He paid her $6 for the goddamn fish. Which reminds me, I'm going to come out there someday and fish in that pond. I hear there are still some big browns in there, and it's not like she'll ever notice. We'll go fishing, and then you can either quit or we'll get you fired. You gotta get out of there, man. You even smell like a girl. You smell like suntan lotion or something. What are you doing, basking on the diving board?" It was the baby wipes and the baby powder. Skip was thinking about how to explain away the smell when Debbie blew through the swinging door from the back room, but not before Chris narrowed his eyes and looked at Skip like he was seeing him through smoke. "Yeah, yeah, yeah," said Debbie, knowing she was late, pulling the letter from the back pocket of her jeans. 2 minutes and he was out in the parking lot, the rain so heavy that he couldn't make out his truck right away. He turned on the interior light and ripped open the envelope like it mattered, like the old man really had something to say to him after all these years. He was amazed by the faint pulse of hope he felt in his own throat. On lined paper like the kind he used in school, his father had written, "Son, we thought you would like to know that you have a baby brother. His name is Lance. He eats good but doesn't sleep all that much. Maybe you can come see him soon when he's sleeping better. Take care of yourself and have a drink on me. Your father." A $10 bill fluttered from inside the letter to the floor of the truck. Skip leaned over and picked it up, then let it fall again. He started up the engine and peeled out from the parking lot onto the flooded road, his back end fishtailing. He wondered whether his father's wife had the same baby books he had, and whether she'd found out yet that the newborn diapers were too small for most babies and cut into the soft skin of their upper thighs. He'd be goddamned if he'd tell her, or send a card. Lance Cuddy, what the hell kind of name was Lance? A soap opera name was what? Lights came up on him suddenly out of the wall of water, a car heading his way, and both of them slowed down, afraid that the wind and the rain might just blow them headlong into each other. He was lucky with the lightning. It zigzagged toward the earth a minute later, and when he was edging over the bridge over the big creek, and in the strange silver light, he could see that someone had already blown out the guardrail on one side, so that there was a drop of 10 feet or so to the creek bed. He went across at maybe 5 miles an hour, praying for his old, bald tires not to slide on the bridge grid. He couldn't afford to have an accident, not with the baby at home sleeping steadily toward her next bottle. There was a car up ahead on one side of the road. Its front end an accordion pleated around the engine block, and he pulled up behind it, his brights on, and ran to the driver's side to see if anyone was hurt. But the car was empty, empty with the emptiness of an abandoned house. And as he got back into the truck, soaked and shivering, he realized that he was at the Boatwright House, where cars were ranged around the drive and the lawn the way some people planted petunias. The Boatwright women all looked as though they'd been inflated with a bicycle pump and encased in stretch fabrics. The Boatwright men were short and wiry and always carried shotguns and cigarettes. Boatwright kids had gray skin and bad haircuts. In grade school, there had been Boatwright twins in their class, girls with big round arms and raggedy bangs. For a nickel, they'd show their privates behind the athletic field bleachers. As he crawled through the valley, the water running across the road in rills of mud and gravel, Skip realized that it was less than a mile from the Boatwrights to Blessings. And for a moment he was afraid that his wet engine would stall and he would be caught in the Boatwright world forever. The way a lot of the guys he knew had been, since Boatwright girls would sleep with anyone and sleeping with a Boatwright girl just about guaranteed a pregnancy. For one terrible moment he imagined that his baby was a Boatwright. But he knew it couldn't be true. She was too plump, too pink, her nose and chin too distinct. Besides, there was no such thing as an unwanted child among the Boatwrights, just as there was no such thing as a wanted one. Babies just happened. Lance Cuddy, he said to himself, Lance goddamn Cuddy. He almost missed the turnoff into the driveway as many times as he'd taken it. Would have missed it if the birch trees had not made a ghostly show just before the fence curved in. At first he thought it was because of the rain, which was impenetrable, nearly as deep as the night, dark gray on black. But as he came down the long drive and around the big circle, the back of the house on one side of him and the front of the garage on the other, no lights came on to illuminate the truck, and from inside the house he could hear a high, thin, screaming sound. He threw the truck into park and ran up the back steps to the big house, and then realized that what he was hearing was the sound of the alarm. He knocked and knocked at the back door, cursing Nadine, who had refused to give him the alarm code or even show him how it worked. "You don't need," she'd said, looking at him as though he had one hand on the strap to her purse. Upstairs in the apartment over the garage, the rain made a hard, heavy noise on the roof. There were no lights there either, not even the red glow of the clock on the stove in the kitchen. He felt his way to the drawer by the refrigerator and took out the flashlight. Outside the kitchen window that looked back over the fields and then the long tangle of forest, he could see nothing but the rain. His work boots sounded of wet as he squeaked down the worn wooden hallway floor. Like the birches that had been beacons on the road, there were two small columns of white in the living room, two candles burning on the old steamer trunk. Slowly he swung the flashlight up and saw Mrs. Blessing sitting on the sagging chair, holding a light-colored raincoat to her throat, 2 feet of wet white cotton hanging beneath its folds. A scarf with some pattern of flowers was tied over her hair.
"Jesus Christ," Skip breathed, "you scared the hell out of me."
"Don't speak to me about being frightened," Mrs. Blessing said. "I've been here all alone, no electricity, no power, no light for who knows how long. And that hideous alarm sound."
"Did you call the alarm people?"
"The phone's gone, too. Everything's down. And then there's a terrible smell of burning, and I don't know where."